Thank you. Okay, our topic for this evening is American Zionism after 1948. And we're not going to discuss the whole period of 1948 to the present. It's impossible. We're going to focus on basically the first decade after the establishment of the state. And in the last half of tonight's session, focus on a particular incident, the Blaustein-Ben-Gurion episode, which we touched on a couple of years ago briefly, but I want to spend more time on that. Okay, so in 1947, there was an article in one of the American Jewish magazines decrying foolish speculation that after the establishment of a Jewish state, that the establishment of that state would absolve American Zionists and the American Zionist movement of any future responsibilities. The theory was that that's wrong. It's not true. It's foolish speculation, because in fact, the establishment of the state would just be the beginning, and that Zionism was never only about the establishment of a political state, but rather about the national rejuvenation of the Jewish people. American Zionists certainly realized that there would be certain things that would have to change after independence, but they didn't realize that within a decade of that independence, their movement would become obsolete, irrelevant, and that they would be denigrated by their own former colleagues for being ideological failures. Okay, so in 1948, 1 million out of the 5 million American Jews had some Zionist affiliation, some organization. 250,000 people were dues-paying members of the ZOA, the Zionist Organization of America. Almost all the leaders of the new Israeli government had titles in the World Zionist Organization. To them, a strong Zionist Organization of America, a strong ZOA, was menacing. Menacing. Why? What's so terrible? Why would an Israeli leader in the cabinet in late 1948 regard a strong ZOA as menacing? Any ideas? No? Okay, so the answer is twofold. One,
it would provide another base of independent thought and independent
correct action. Good. So in the earlier time, pre-1948, it was a tag team. The diaspora Zionists and the Palestinian Zionists doing whatever they could to fight British policy. But now they were the government. The Zionists were the government in Eretz Israel, and they didn't want outsiders meddling in internal Israeli affairs. So if you weaken the ZOA, you don't have any competitor trying to boss you around. But secondly, there's a political angle to this, a partisan political angle. The Holocaust killed off the core of labor Zionists in the Chutz La'aretz, in the diaspora. Poland, Lithuania, Russia, okay. Avodah, Mifleget Avodah, labor Zionism, their thousands, their millions of potential adherents were now gone, dead. And the Mapai did not want the more conservative Zionist Organization of America to align itself with the center and right-wing parties in Israel and be an alternative power base. In other words, the ZOA was not socialist, because Americans generally, by the 1950s, were not socialist, and not even American Jews. So what center-right parties were there in Israel in the early years? Well, there was Herut, Begin's party, but there was also the Liberal Party, the Progressive Party, these general Zionists. And a couple of years ago when we did Israeli politics, so we covered all that stuff. And the Mapai, Mifleget Pole Eretz Yisrael, was not interested in having diaspora American Jews in cahoots with center and right-wing parties. Okay. So Emanuel Neumann, who was the president of the ZOA, proposed a division of labor. The Israeli government would handle domestic affairs, as is naturally the case for a sovereign state. It'll handle its internal affairs. And it will also handle foreign affairs as they reflect interactions with foreign governments. We'll get to the funding issue in a second, Norman. So the Israelis will handle domestic matters and foreign diplomacy. The ZOA, or rather the World Zionist Organization and the Jewish Agency, would handle the diaspora and handle immigration up to the point that the diaspora Jew reaches the shores of Israel. Then the Israeli Ministry of Absorption will take over. This was a very logical division of labor and basically had been in effect since the 1930s, because already since the 1930s, the Jewish Agency was the domestic government for the Jews of Eretz Israel, and the World Zionist Organization handled all the Chutz La'aretz activities. So this was a nice idea, but Newman insisted on one more thing. He insisted on hafrada. What does hafrada mean? It's a Hebrew word, hafrada. What does it mean? So it means separation. What is the separation we're talking about? That Israeli government officials must resign from the WZO and from the Jewish Agency in order so that there be no overlap, because if there were overlap, it would result in problems of dual loyalty. Meaning, if you want the ZOA, the WZO, the Jewish Agency, to be dictating terms for diaspora Jewry, but one of their executive leaders is the prime minister of a sovereign country, then you really have a dual loyalty problem. As opposed to if no such people are on the board, and it's just, you know, a voluntary association, transnational voluntary association, without any sovereign figures involved, then it's fine. Okay, so at first, Ben-Gurion and the others refused. They did not want Hafrada. But eventually they were convinced that they had to. They all had to resign their posts, just take whatever prerogatives of Israeli leadership they have, you know, the perks of being in the cabinet, but out of the ZOA, out of the WZO. Okay. But Hafrada did not work seamlessly on either side. For example, Malcolm Goldman, the president of the WZO, insisted upon sitting in on Israeli cabinet meetings. And Ben-Gurion says, the chutzpah of him. Who does he think he is? You know, get out. Nobody really knew their place, because all these people had been working together in the pre-state era, but now they're not together. There's this international organization, and there's also a sovereign country. So a formal arrangement had to be put into place to regulate relations between Israel and World Zionism. That regulation, that law, was passed by the Knesset on November 24th, 1952. Why was did even the Israeli leaders acknowledge that the WZO and the Jewish Agency still had a role to play after the founding of the state? Very simply, they acknowledged that 4/5 of world Jewry, 80% of world Jewry, doesn't live in Israel. It lives in the diaspora, at least back in 1952. And only a voluntary worldwide organization could achieve certain things where the hand of a sovereign state could not tread, okay? So Ben-Gurion's next task was to emasculate the Zionist Organization of America. And one of the ways he did it was to take away its clout in fundraising, that the United Palestine Appeal was dominated by the Zionist movement in America. It was replaced with a new organization, the United Israel Appeal, where money was primarily coming from non-Zionists and was flowing through local federations. So you reach the people at a local level and you get the money of the wealthy non-Zionists and you sideline organizational Zionism and take away one of their major bases of power, which was the kesef, the money. Prior to 1948, the Zionist Organization of America had three basic jobs. One was political advocacy for the cause of Jewish statehood. Secondly, it was educational, teach about Jewish nationalism to American Jews. And thirdly, it was fundraising, dig deep into the pockets of wealthy American Jews and not so wealthy American Jews and send the money across the ocean to Eretz Israel. Well, statehood eliminated the political angle. Now the Israeli Foreign Ministry will take care of all that stuff. And the reorganization of the United Israel Appeal took away the fundraising angle. So the last thing that, the only thing of the three planks that the ZOA had going for it was education. But to be honest, on the educational issue, the Zionist Organization of America had always been a big failure. And one of the reasons is because American Jewry is too divided for the Zionist movement to take over the Talmud Torahs, the yeshivas, the cheders. It never really happened. Okay, so with all this in mind, the ZOA is foundering. They're not doing all that well. However, specialty Zionist groups would do well. What am I referring to when I say specialty Zionist groups? Well, Hadassah, the ladies, and Mizrahi, the religious. Why do they do well? Because they focus on pet projects of their own that also happen to have the support of the Israeli government and engage their people with a concrete thing across the ocean. So Hadassah has, you know, the hospital, the medical school. It has its things that it raises money for that you could put your finger on and say, that's what we built. Mizrahi had similar things, you know, religious schools, Dati Lumi institutions, that the state was supporting through the Ministry of Religious Affairs and the World Zionist Organization's Torah Department or Education Department. So Mizrahi had something it was doing too. The Poel Etzion, the socialist Zionists in America, would bask in the glory of the victories of Mapai in Israel, although, to be honest, they offered nothing to the American Jews because American Jews weren't interested in socialist Zionism here in America. But the ZOA as a broader institution was doing very poorly. And even the residual political stuff that they might have taken a charge of was handled by other people. And next week, we'll talk about that at length. AIPAC, Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations, the American Jewish Committee, meaning other organizations took on important roles in Jewish political advocacy that the ZOA thought it was its bailiwick, and it turned out they did nothing. Okay. So in the 1950s, Zionists were dispirited and needed to redefine their mission. In the 1950s, Israelis believed that you could no longer talk Zionism. You had to do Zionism. And that meant Aliyah, personal fulfillment of going up to Israel. Zionism, Tzionut, in the 1950s, was a euphemism for claptrap, for talking Narishkeit. You don't, it was like a dirty word. Okay. So diaspora Zionism had become an outmoded anachronism. In America, the diaspora Zionists criticized themselves for failing to meet the spiritual and cultural needs of diaspora Jews. In other words, the focus of Jewish culture in America really was not on, you know, the Hebrew society being built up in Eretz Israel. It was distinctly American, and the Zionists were not contributing much to it. Except maybe if you went to Yeshiva Flatbush, okay? Then it was an exception. So Brandeisian Zionism, that of Louis Brandeis, was a synthesis, a synthesis of two things. One was give money. The second was find out where your money is going and be engaged in the process of building up whatever institutions in Eretz Israel that your money is going to support. And if you don't do the synthesis, if you only do the money, but you don't do the follow-up, then your money to Israel is just charity. It's not really much of Zionism. It's just another tzedakah. And that was one of the big problems that American Jewry faced. They gave the kesef, but there was very little follow-up. They didn't know what was going on. Now, to be honest, and this is my chiddush, that this, you know, the scholarly articles written in American Jewish historical publications don't bother to say this. It was one thing for Louis Brandeis to do follow-up because he was a Supreme Court justice and a rich man, and he could go to Eretz Israel and he could give the time and effort. But, you know, in the 1940s and 50s, it wasn't so simple to go to Israel. Today, it's a 9.5-hour plane ride on the Dreamliner, okay, and we have the internet. So we can engage organizations and institutions and places in Israel very easily and go there. In the early years of statehood, that wasn't really possible. So the fact that it was just kesef donations with little follow-up, I think that was inevitable. Okay. Different values and concepts motivated Palestinian Zionists and American Zionists. For the Israelis, they were ending the Galut. They were ending the dispersion. For the Americans, they were rescuing European Jewry from destruction. And in 1945 through 1948, there was a confluence of those motivations to build up the state after the Holocaust. But after 1948, the ideological chasm in between these two positions had become too great. American Jews were like a mother who married off a Mazinka child, like a mother married off its last child. Like, you know, what do we do now? You know, all the kids are out of the house. They're all married off. You know, Israel exists. What do we do now? Okay. But for American Jewry and for American Zionists who are not ready to make Aliyah personally, but who want to be more than just friends, you have to find some happy medium. It's more than just a friendship, but it's not I'm moving there myself. There's something more intense than friendship, less intense than Aliyah, but what is that? And they had to figure that out. So that's why Melvin Yurovsky, who's a leading scholar, who was leading scholar of American Zionism, his articles on this kufa, this period, are often titled A Cause in Search of Itself. A Cause in Search of Itself, meaning Zionism is a cause, and it's searching for itself. It doesn't know what it really is. You know, it's achieved something, but that wasn't supposed to be everything. But what do we do now? So the new focus would be Mordechai Kaplan's approach of strengthening Jewish nationalism in the diaspora and to make Israel a more Zionist state, meaning not just demographically majority Jewish, which it was, you know, after the Palestinian Arab exodus and the arrival of the Holocaust survivors. So Israel was firmly demographically Jewish by the early 50s. But was it really a Zionist state in the sense of Kimi Tzion Teitzei Torah or Tzion Mishpat Tipadeh, Zion will be redeemed to justice. So make it more ideologically Zionist. Somehow, a synthesis had to be made of Ahavat Yisrael, love of Israel, and Ahavat America, love of America. You got to somehow bridge the difference. Diaspora Zionism would be the counterpoint to the Canaanite movement. That in Israel, there were Canaanites, Canaanim. Now, these Canaanim were Jews, but they were Meshugayim. They said, we'll be like the Canaanim, that we live here in the land of Canaan, land of Israel, and we have no shaychus, no connection to the Jews of the diaspora. They're not us and we're not them. Canaanism. So diaspora Zionism says, baloney, we're all Jewish and we're all in this together. And you're not a Canaanite and therefore a kinsman of the local Arabs, you're a Jew. Okay. So for Kaplanian diaspora Zionism, religion, nationalism, and culture are all parts of Judaism as a civilization, classic Kaplan formulation. But this diaspora Zionism was really irrelevant in the 1950s because it wasn't what American Jewry was looking for. American Jewry in the 1950s was very American and not very nationalistic. New Zionism would only find its footing after the Six-Day War. After the Six-Day War, then American Jewry came to be dominated by pro-Israel sentiment, effectively Zionistic sentiment, such that Norman Podhoretz would say, we are all Zionists now, or we are one, was the slogan of the United Israel Appeal. And I would say that from 1967 through about the late 80s, early 90s, this pro-Israelism or American Zionism came to dominate American Jewish life. Of course, it no longer does. You just have to look at all the Jews who are protesting against Israel today to know that this is far from the truth now. But it was true for some length of time. So you could say about American Zionism and the American Jewish community that, you know, in the 60s, 70s, into the 80s, American Jews did march to a Zionist beat, but it was not the Zionist movement calling the tune. In other words, the movement organizationally was weak, was schwach, but the popular sentiment was roughly along those lines. Okay, so in the chat, Norman and Asher are mentioning the campaign of 1956. So you're right that the campaign of 56, the Sinai campaign, did increase fervor among American Jews for the cause of Israel. It also meant that American Jews voted for Adlai Stevenson more so than American Gentiles did, because a lot of American Jews were dissatisfied with Eisenhower and the way he handled that, which was not a very pro-Israel perspective. Not that I'm blaming Eisenhower necessarily. He wasn't an enemy of the Jewish people, but far from it. But the way he busted Israel's chops in 56 and early 57 didn't sit well with American Zionists. Okay, so now let's get to the Blaustein-Ben-Gurion affair, as we might call it, or exchange of notes. So, what happened? An exchange of views between Jacob Blaustein, the president of the American Jewish Committee, and David Ben-Gurion, the prime minister of Israel, caused a major stir in the Jewish world in 1950, but is now just a footnote of history, and most of you, of the 60 people listening today, probably never heard of it, unless you heard of it when I mentioned it like a couple of years ago in a past lecture. But it's not something that everybody knows about. But at the time, it was a very big deal. And what happened? It tells us about the attitudes of a segment of the American Jewish leadership and of Israeli officials towards each other. It was the only ever example of diaspora Jewry successfully pressuring the Israeli government to change policy without any local support in Israel for that change of policy, meaning the Chutz La'aretz folks were able to bludgeon the Israelis into changing a policy position, even though nobody on the ground in Medina Israel really cared to make any changes. So why did it happen this time? And we'll read bits and pieces of the text to give you a flavor of what happened. So it happened in this instance because it was a statement and a symbol, not an actual policy. No concrete thing changed. It's just words on a page. Now, words matter. Ideology matters, but it's not as important as concrete in the ground. Secondly, it was early in the years of statehood when Israel was first getting its footing. It would never happen today that Netanyahu or Ariel Sharon or Ehud Olmert or Ehud Barak or Yitzhak Rabin or whomever would have caved to diaspora pressure with nobody bothering him in Israel about it. But in 1950, Ben-Gurion was in a different environment. And thirdly, Israel capitulated because it would later violate its agreement anyway. So since it was only words and they weren't going to live by it, who cares? It was enough comfort to worry about dual loyalty charges. Well, at the time, there are concerns of dual loyalty charges that are the diaspora Jews are asserting is a problem because of Israeli policies. And Ben-Gurion wants to throw them a bone, so he does. Prior to the establishment of the state, Zionist leaders saw the American Jewish Committee as the key to getting American Jewish money and political influence, meaning these are the guys with the deep pockets, and they know the president and the senators and the congressmen in Washington. So we have to curry favor with this American Jewish Committee if we know it's good for us. It's where our challah is buttered, okay? So the problem is the American Jewish Committee was anti-Zionist, or at best, non-Zionist, but certainly not pro-Zionist. In 1929, the Jewish Agency was expanded to include non-Zionists. This was done by the president of the American Jewish Committee, Louis Marshall, shortly before he died, and together in cahoots with Chaim Weizmann. Weizmann did this because he understood that he needed American Jewish money, and the money was in the hands of the wealthy German Jewish elite, and they were not Zionists, but if you give them a little clout over what goes on in Eretz Yisrael via the Jewish Agency, then they'll give money. And they did. So it worked. The expansion of the Jewish Agency worked. Okay. But the non-Zionists, while supportive of the Yishuv, objected to Jewish statehood for ideological and practical reasons. The American Jewish Committee was opposed to Jewish statehood, but when the American government supported partition, the American Jewish Committee fell in lockstep with the American government, meaning we don't have to be more Catholic than the Pope. That if the American government's okay with it, who are we to say we're against it? Then, the American Jewish Committee, the AJC, was given the opportunity to review a draft of the Israeli constitution. Now, wait a second. Israel has a constitution? That's news to me. Israel doesn't have a constitution. Well, they tried. And if you recall, a couple of years ago, we discussed Israel's attempts at a constitution. And this was a serious attempt in the early years of statehood. But it fell short. And instead, they had the basic laws. But in the beginning, there was a draft. And they sent the American Jewish Committee a copy to see, what do you think of this draft, of this constitution for a Jewish state? And what the American Jewish Committee lawyers stressed in their markup, in their footnotes, in red ink on this draft, was that make it more Israeli and less Jewish. More Israeli and less Jewish. Don't speak in the name of world Jewry, because you are not world Jewry. You are the state of Israel. And that's a very narrow thing, the state of Israel, one of many states in the world. But Jews are a transnational religious entity, and you don't speak for everybody. So be careful how you couch things, okay? So in 1948, in May, Blaustein went to Israel just after the state was established, and he met with Ben-Gurion. And Ben-Gurion made a promise, an assurance, to the visiting American dignitaries that Israel and he himself, Ben-Gurion, would not speak in the name of world Jewry. That it was like verboten. You don't do that. You know, I'm the prime minister of a country, but I don't speak for world Jewry. That was the promise that he made. And the other thing that the American Jewish Committee folks extracted, a concession from Ben-Gurion and from the government, was do not propagandize in North America, especially in the United States, about mass aliyah from Eretz Yisrael, from America. Do not speak anywhere or come to America and talk to our folks and say that you expect them to all move to Palestine, to Medinat Yisrael, the state of Israel. Now, why? Why should you not do this? And why might they be inclined to do it? Well, they're inclined to do it because aliyah is a core principle of Zionism. The individual Jew will achieve his Jewish self-fulfillment, actualization, in the land of Israel, and only in the land of Israel, that you can't do it in the Galut, the Shtilat HaGalut, the negation of the diaspora. And Americans don't want to hear this because Americans don't want to hear it. You know, it's an uncomfortable thing. We're not interested in getting up and going. America is our home, so don't hit us over the head with this. This is propaganda. Stop it. Okay. So in 1949, Ben-Gurion gave a speech doing just that, propagandizing for mass aliyah from North America. And he went so far as to say that the Jewish youth should override the wishes of their parents and move to Eretz Yisrael. In other words, mommy and daddy want you to go to Columbia and become a doctor? No, move to the Galilee and become a farmer. So this is already a dangerous thing. You know, you don't mess around with the middle-class bourgeois American Jews and their lifestyle. So Blaustein and his henchmen in the American Jewish Committee basically lash out at Ben-Gurion and say, who do you think you are to come to our turf and try to poach our best and brightest? You know, little Irving wants to go to Columbia or to NYU and become an upper middle class Jew in suburban New York. He doesn't want to go to Jerusalem and Tel Aviv. So in his fury, Blaustein threatened that the American Jewish Committee would reconsider its support for Israel if the Israeli government kept promoting Aliyah and interfering in the internal Jewish affairs of America. He went so far as to threaten to adopt the attitude of the American Council for Judaism. Now, that's a real threat, because the American Council for Judaism was as far over as you could get. Let me read to you what he wrote. So Blaustein wrote the following: I am reasoning with you, and your answer to me, to my mind, is going to determine whether my attitude of reasonableness is to be thrown into the ash can, and the philosophy of the American Council for Judaism is to prevail. for obviously people like myself cannot be expected to ask American contributions to funds intended in part to achieve such an un-American aim as the emigration of all American Jews to Israel. Nor can we be expected to sit silent under the attacks that will follow shortly unless this situation is corrected. So he's talking tough to Ben-Gurion. All right, well, what happens next? So there was a response on October 22nd, 1949 from Ambassador Eliyahu Eilat, the Israeli ambassador to America, that Ben-Gurion had been misquoted and that he only wanted a selected immigration from America, meaning we want some Jews from America, not everybody. We're not pressuring anybody. Just, you know, some Jews will move from America to Israel. Okay. The American Jewish Congress, formerly led by Stephen Wise, although at this point Stephen Wise was dead, he died in 1949, lambasted their competitors, the American Jewish Committee, for trying to blackmail the state of Israel into doing its bidding. You're blackmailing the Israelis with all these threats. So Blaustein wasn't done. He wanted Israel to stop spreading world Jewish nationalist philosophy in America. Why did he insist that this come to an end? One, because philanthropic assistance was at stake. If you don't stop, the money's going to stop. Two, the goodwill of American Jewry will be lost if you don't stop this nationalist bid. Now, let's just pause for a second. It's one thing for him to threaten that the money's going to get cut off, because after all, the American Jewish Committee guys really do control the purse strings. But the goodwill of American Jewry, let me ask you a serious question. Do you think that the goodwill of American Jewry was going to be lost by Ben-Gurion and Golda and Abba Iban coming to America and saying that they really want Aliyah? Baloney. It wasn't going to happen. So the American Jewish Committee was talking, you know, its own ideological game, but really it's a farce. Okay, but the third reason why Blaustein insisted that Ben-Gurion have to cut out his act is that it would be a coup for the American Jewish Committee and for Blaustein personally if he were to be able to strong arm a head of government. You know, it's not so simple for a private citizen to strong arm the head of a country. And yet, if he could pull it off, like it's like a feather in his cap, you know? The fourth thing is the Zionists continued to not to cooperate and to stress ideological principle of Aliyah. So since Ben-Gurion had made promises, but they weren't keeping the promises, it's time to stick it to him and insist that he make a public declaration that they'll behave themselves. Okay, so Blaustein visited Israel in August of 1950, and he negotiated with Ben-Gurion for hours and hours and hours. And on August 23rd, 1950, at a luncheon in Yerushalayim, they exchanged their views. So I'm now going to read substantial portions of that exchange of views. First, Ben-Gurion's remarks, and then Blaustein's remarks. So Ben-Gurion, first of all, welcomes the great representatives of American Jewry for coming. He thanks them for all the good work that they've been doing. Fine. And then he says, we've worked together on what? On the urgent task of providing permanent homes to hundreds of thousands of our brethren who cannot remain where they are and whose heart is set on rebuilding their lives in Israel. Meaning, you rich American Jews and we Zionist leaders were able to make sure that hundreds of thousands of Holocaust survivors and Sephardic Jews from the Middle East were able to leave wherever they were because they couldn't stay there and they weren't welcome where they were and rebuild their lives in Israel because they wanted to rebuild their lives in Israel. Now, that's a little hint that, hey, you American Jews might not want to come here, but there are hundreds of thousands of people who did want to come here, and they did, and we worked together to make it possible. Then, in this great task, you and we are engaged in close partnership. So, now for all your talk that you're angry with us, we're close partners. It is most unfortunate that there's some confusion and misunderstanding should have arisen between Israel and the community of American Jewry. And friendship and close understanding are vital necessity, meaning I acknowledge Ben-Gurion says, we can't afford to have a falling out. We can't afford to have a falling out. The Jews of the United States, as a community and as individuals, have only one political attachment, and that is to the United States of America. They owe no political allegiance to Israel. So right off the bat, the first real substantive comment that Ben-Gurion is making is this point, that you guys are politically loyal to America. You have no particular allegiance to Israel. Let that be said openly and unambiguously. So he needed to say this to win over his interlocutor, because that was the critical point. No, avoid the due loyalty charge. Then, the state of Israel represents and speaks only on behalf of its own citizens, and in no way presumes to speak or in the name of Jews or who are citizens of any other country. Now, to be honest, this actually goes back to the Balfour Declaration, which focused on two problematic groups. One problematic group is the Arabs of Eretz Israel, or the non-Jews of Eretz Israel, that their rights should not be infringed. And the other are the Jews of the diaspora, who aren't going to go to Eretz Israel, that their rights should not be infringed. So now here Ben-Gurion is saying, we don't speak for any of those guys. They're not our folks. Maybe they're our religious kinsmen or national kinsmen, but they're not co-citizens, so we're not going to speak for you. Okay, then. We, the people of Israel, have no desire and no intention to interfere in any way with the internal affairs of Jewish communities abroad. So that was the accusation that was leveled against him. And he's saying, we don't want to do that. It's not what we have in mind. That we respect the integrity of the communities abroad. And furthermore, any weakening of American Jewry, any disruption of its communal life, or lowering of its sense of security, or diminution of its status, is a definite loss to Jews everywhere, and to Israel in particular. Meaning, we, State of Israel, are not interested in being the reason why American Jewry loses its political power or its economic power. We don't want to be the reason why you guys are accused in America, in New York, in Philadelphia, Los Angeles, Chicago, of dual loyalty and you lose your political clout. That would be bad for us. So not only would it be bad for you, it would be bad for us. So we're not interested in having that happen. We're looking to do the right thing. Then, we therefore are anxious that nothing should be said or done which could in the slightest degree undermine the sense of security and stability of American Jewry. Ben-Gurion is saying all the right things. He's hitting all the keynotes. We don't want to cause you any trouble. Okay, then. But the key paragraph is the second to last paragraph. In this connection, let me say a word about immigration. Immigration. Now notice, he doesn't use the word aliyah. Aliyah has a necessarily positive connotation. Going up, that the diaspora is bad, Eretz Israel is good, it's going up. He says immigration, it's a neutral term. So we shall like to see American Jews come and take part in our effort. We need their technical knowledge, unrivaled experience, spirit of enterprise, bold vision, and know-how. We need engineers, chemists, builders, managers, workers, technicians. Okay, we have a big project ahead of us, the American genius for technological development and social progress. So basically, what Ben-Gurion is saying is, you guys, you rich American Jewish community, not only have money, you also have people with specific skills that would be of great use to us here in the backward Medinat Israel. We're a brand new country with a lot of poor people that just came off the boat, and we need help, practical help, and you guys could give it. So, but the decision as to whether they wish to come permanently or temporarily rests with the free discretion of each American Jew himself. It's entirely a matter of his own volition. In other words, we're not forcing anybody to come to Israel. We're not forcing Aliyah. We don't have the ability to do it. We wouldn't do it if we could. Every person makes a choice for themselves and whether they come temporarily or permanently. So why does he mention temporarily? Because there were many American Jews who did go to Eretz Yisrael but didn't stay there. They went on Machal or Gachal. They fought in the army. They helped to establish the Air Force or the Navy. Okay, and then they were involved in the late 40s, early 50s in some business ventures in Israel and some technological breakthroughs in Israel. But then, after a few years' time, went back to America. There are many such heroes in the history of the state who were Americans, but who didn't stick around, who went back to America. And so that's what he's referring to. Then, we need chalutzim, pioneers, too. Chalutzim have come to us, and we believe more will come, not only from those countries where Jews are oppressed and in exile, but also from countries where Jews live in a life of freedom with equal status. But the essence of chalutziyut is a free choice. They will come from among those who believe that their aspirations as human beings and as Jews can best be fulfilled by a life and work in Israel. In other words, we want experts, sure, but we also want rank and file people who have no particular talent, but who are willing to become chalutzim and till the soil take a shovel in hand and dig a ditch. That, you know, the average person doesn't have necessarily the most marketable of skills, but they can do manual labor. So we want such people, and we want such people not only from the remnant of the Shoah, the Sheres HaPleita, the leftover population of the Shoah, and not only from the backward Islamic countries of the Sephardic population, but also from the rich Western Jewish communities like America or England or Canada or South Africa or Australia. We want those people too, okay? And why might they come? Because they feel that their lives will be more fulfilling Jewishly and as human beings in a life of work in Israel. Okay, so none of what Ben-Gurion said was offensive to Blaustein or to non-Zionist American Jews. Ben-Gurion is making extra effort to say all the right things and with the right terminology and with no offense given or taken. Okay, the last piece of the puzzle, he says, is, I believe I know something about the spirit of American Jewry, among whom I lived for some years. So now he's saying, I used to be an American Jew. I know about you guys. And I think I can count on you to come here and, you know, do good for us. When did Ben-Gurion live in America? During World War I. Okay, from 1915 to 1918, he was in America, hanging out in the New York Public Library, doing some work. Okay, so that's Ben-Gurion. Now let's go to Blaustein. So Blaustein thanks his host for inviting him, and he congratulates Israel on winning a war against impossible odds. And he says, I witnessed your great achievements. You've done such wonderful things. Okay, you conquered the Negev and the stony rocks of the Galilee. So you're involved in a great task of reconstruction and rehabilitation, and you have large economic problems, and you have tremendous problems looming ahead. So he's warning them, you know, life is not going to be a picnic, a cakewalk for you. Yes, you won a war against the Arabs, but building up a state is going to be a great challenge. Implied is a great challenge that you can't handle on your own. You need us, and because you need us, you've got to play by some of my rules. Okay, so he then goes on to say, Israel is a stronghold of democracy in an area where liberal democracy is practically unknown. So this is classic, you know, Hasbara Zionism, except it's coming from a non-Zionist like Blaustein, saying, oh, Israel is the only democracy in the Middle East, and it's a bastion of light and freedom in an otherwise dark world. Okay, good for him. Then he goes on to say that the Israeli people want democracy and will not accept any dictatorship or totalitarianism from within or from without. Why does he bother mentioning that? What is, why, as a guest of the state, talking to Ben-Gurion about diaspora Israeli relations, is he harping on this business of they're not going to accept totalitarianism where you are? So the answer is because there were plenty of American Jews who including those who had a soft spot in their heart for the newly established state of Israel, who worried that Ben-Gurion wasn't really a Democrat, lowercase d, that he was a tyrant. And there's something to be said for that. Listen, he ran at things with an iron fist. True, he won these elections, and he consistently won elections, but Israel was not the most democratic state in its beginning, its early years. There were structural problems with it. Okay, so he says, democracy is the fundamental basis of Judaism, and democracy is against totalitarianism. So Judaism is against totalitarianism. American Jewry has tied its fortunes, he says, to the fate of the liberal democracy in the United States. Meaning, we are hanging our hat on the fact that America is a great country. And why is it a great country? Because it's a liberal democracy. And here we can find, in a menuchas nefesh, we can find stability and freedom and comfort and tranquility after, you know, centuries of being wandering Jews. As to Israel, the vast majority of American Jewry recognizes the necessity and desirability of helping make it a strong, viable, and self-supporting state. Meaning,
even the non-Zionists, want Israel to succeed and to wean itself off of charity and outside assistance. There's only a handful of really fabrenta anti-Zionists who want to see Israel fail and be replaced by some Arab-Palestinian state. I mean, maybe back then there was almost nobody to that effect. And he's saying, you know, even us non-Zionists, we want you guys to be successful. And we've been active, he says, within the framework of our American citizenship to support Israel every way possible. So within the framework of our American citizenship, you know what that means? That means that Blaustein, as an American non-Zionist who has a soft spot in his heart for Israel, he's not, within the framework of his citizenship, going to run guns for the Irgun out of Brooklyn Harbor, violating the embargo that the American government placed upon Palestine. You know, Rabbi Lamb and his fellow students from Yeshiva College and Torah Vadas, so they, among others, would run guns for the Haganah and for the Irgun right out of Brooklyn. But it was breaking the law. You could have gotten arrested. Blaustein is saying, we're going to support Israel, but we're not going to break any rules here, you know, within our citizenship. So then, the key paragraph. While Israel has naturally placed some burdens on Jews elsewhere, particularly in America, it has in turn meant much to the Jews throughout the world. For hundreds of thousands in Europe, Africa, and the Middle East, it has provided a home in which they can attain their full measure of human dignity for the first time. In all Jews, it has inspired pride and admiration, even though in some instances, it has created passing headaches. So here you have an American Jew saying, oy vey, the state of Israel, yeah, we take pride in it, we admire it, but it gives us a bunch of headaches, the state of Israel, and it causes us a bunch of problems. And who's it good for? It's good for the Jews from the bad countries, from Europe, from the Middle East, from Asia, from Africa. Those poor Jews, schleppy Jews from there, they need Israel. We American Jews, we don't really need it. And we support it because we have a soft spot in our heart, but it causes us a lot of headaches. A little bit of a chutzpahdik statement to make. Okay, then. Israel's rebirth after World War II has done much to raise Jewish morale. So he acknowledges that people are proud of Israel and it raises the morale. But now the birth pains are over, he says. And even though Israel has growing pains, still, the matter of goodwill is a two-way street. You, Israel, expect something from us, American Jews, money, political support, whatever it is. We expect something from you, namely, that your pronouncements and your propaganda will not be offensive to our sentiment. Okay? So don't do anything that adversely affects we, the citizens of other countries. So, first of all, he says, we repudiate any notion that American Jewry is in exile. We are not in the Galut. America is our Zion, or America is our home. Okay? And, key point, if democracy should fail in America, then it will fail everywhere, and Israel won't be a safe haven either. In other words, if America fails, that's the apocalypse. So yes, people, diaspora Jews should always be aware that we have a golden age and then some decline and then a new community emerges and then a new community emerges after the decline of the next one. So yes, there's a cycle of up and down in diaspora communities, Blaustein is acknowledging. But America is the last one, because if America fails, the world comes to an end. Okay, then. We are tied to our Israeli brethren by ties of religion, common historical tradition, and in certain respects, a common destiny. Notice he doesn't say national identity. So we, American Jews, don't speak in your name, and you, Israelis, should not attempt to speak in the name of other communities, not the American community, not the Canadian, not the South African, not the Australian, not the whatever. You name a diaspora Jewish community, Israel doesn't speak for them. Harm has been done to the morale and to some extent to the sense of security of American Jewish community through unwise and unwarranted statements. So Blaustein is claiming that American Jewish morale went down because you, Ben Gurion, and Golda Meir, and Abba Ibn, and others were getting a little too fussy about Aliyah and telling us what to do. He's wrong, Blaustein. There was no decline in morale. Maybe there was a decline in his morale from a handful of select snooty elitists, but he's overstating the case. Then he says, even greater harm has been done to the state of Israel itself by weakening the readiness of American Jews to do their full share in rebuilding of Israel. So if he's talking about the millions of rank-and-file Jews, I think he's wrong. But if he's referring to the handful of really rich people who are American Jewish community members who might have been inclined to, as non-Zionists, give to the yeshuv and give to the new state, and now they're offended and they won't, well, then maybe he has a point. Okay. So we have to have mutual respect for the integrity of our communities and our institutions. Done. So that's the end of the statement. Now let's go to the analysis of the statement. The analysis. So, the exchange of views was truly incredible. One, because the very terminology, an exchange of views, suggests that the two parties involved were equal partners, when in reality, one was the head of a country and the other was a private citizen of another country who happens to be the president of an ethnic association, American Jewish Committee. So it's like a misrepresentation of the power dynamic. But then it gets worse. Ben-Gurion's statement was mild and inoffensive and couched in terms to which the other side would not object, whereas Blaustein's tone was belligerent and denied basic Zionist premises. It gives the impression that Blaustein was the dominant party. So not the head of a country, but rather the private citizen who heads an ethnic association is the more powerful and dominant party in this. Ben-Gurion's greatest concession in this exchange of views came on the issue of Aliyah. As I said, he uses the neutral term of immigration rather than the loaded term Aliyah. He did not directly contradict whose analysis is this. So this analysis is partly Melvin Yurovsky and partly my own. But it's really the consensus of the scholars of American Zionism that, you know, Blaustein didn't overplay his hand so much as he's projecting himself as being the dominant party when objectively he really shouldn't be. So Ben-Gurion did not directly contradict his earlier remarks. Nobody had ever said that American Jews would be forced to move to Israel. And so in denying it, he wasn't saying anything opposed to his earlier comments. But he was silent on kibbutz galuyot. If you notice, he never mentions the ideological driving force of the ingathering of the exiles, which is the primary motivation for the Zionist movement. He emphasizes technological skills rather than the more direct reason why he wants more Jews to move to Israel, simply that Israel needs more Jews. You know, in May of 1948, there were more Jews in the Bronx than there were in Israel, right? So, and after the war was over, you know, there was about 1.2 million Jews in Israel after the great wave was over in 51. All right, so they doubled their population in 3 years, which is pretty impressive, but they needed more manpower to combat the Arabs in warfare. So he doesn't mention that. He just mentions we need your technical skills. Also, he gave the impression that American Aliyah would be noblesse oblige by a rich country's citizens to the welfare of a backward state, rather than Aliyah as Jewish self-fulfillment. So he's avoiding the real ideological crux and just talking around the issue, saying, oh, we need some expert skills and some doctors and some engineers, and you'll help us. That's not what he really meant. Okay. It wasn't easy for Ben-Gurion to relent on these issues, and he almost didn't. This exchange of views almost didn't happen. He had to be arm-twisted at the last second by diaspora leaders to make it happen. In the early years after the exchange, Ben-Gurion was very careful how he spoke about Western Aliyah. He would say, we need professionals and managers and scientists. And at a 1951 World Zionist Organization meeting, he stressed Israeli needs rather than Jewish obligations, meaning Israel needs a doctor, not you Jewish doctor need to move to Israel because as a personal thing, you need to move to Israel. Those are very different appeals and pitches. And he did the Israeli need issue, not the Jewish personal obligation issue. So you could be a diaspora Zionist, and you need not adopt a radical perspective of Aliyah or bust. At least in certain public statements, Ben-Gurion would say that in the early 50s. But by 1960, the deal was being violated. And Blaustein wrote to Ben-Gurion complaining. What were some of the complaints? That Israel had gotten involved in swastika issues in the United Kingdom and in Canada and the United States. Well, why is Israel getting involved? This is a domestic Jewish issue. Let the local Jewish community deal with it. Why is Israel getting involved? Also in 1960, Moshe Dayan, a retired general at that point, okay, the hero of the 56 campaign, had said on the record in a Canadian speech that he represented all Jews. Golda Meir said in 1960 that Israel will continue to speak for world Jewry. So this is bedafka what they were not supposed to say. But you know what? They really meant it. And the Blaustein deal was just a fake deal. What was the biggest thing that happened in 1960 that would mean that Israel speaks for all of world Jewry? What happened?
Eichmann.
Bingo. The capture of Adolf Eichmann, okay, and putting him on trial. By what right do Mossad agents have to kidnap Ricardo Clement? None, unless the state of Israel speaks for world Jewry, and world Jewry wants Adolf Eichmann, not Ricardo Clement, to die on the gallows. So this is the most significant case example of we speak for world Jewry when the Blaustein crowd and the American Jewish Committee crowd say, but no, you don't, okay?
The world even viewed Israel as the place of the Jews, i.e. reparations.
That's true. So when it came to the reparations deal with West Germany, you're right that there were some who viewed it that way. However, there was an alternative perspective to the reparations agreement whereby Israel does not represent world Jewry. And what is that? That the money was going for the resettlement of Holocaust survivors or Jewish refugees from Europe in Israel, and that Israel gets the money bedafka because they're going to Israel. Not because Israel is the Jewish state and speaks for world Jewry, but just because the Germans have an obligation towards these particular people, and these people are being resettled and rehabilitated in Israel. So it could have been in Zimbabwe. It could have been in Uganda. It just so happened it was Israel. Therefore, Israel gets the money, right?
Israel also is able, through its military might, to reach out around the world to actually protect Jews. I mean, there is no question about that, whether it's in Entebbe, whether it's
correct.
Anywhere.
So in the 1970s and beyond, but Entebbe being the classic example, Israel would have to defend world Jewry when there's a violent incident and Israeli Jews and diaspora Jews are lumped together by the anti-Semites, and if we're going to rescue one, we're going to rescue all. Okay.
Rabbi, yeah. Was there not a shift in attitude on the part of the American Jewish Congress, which was historically, I think, more in favor of Israel's state, even in the 40s.
Correct.
Than the committee. The committee was always very frisky about all this because they correct. Were very into, we're American and that comes yeah. first and we don't want to endanger our future. But the Congress was much more hospitable to the idea.
That's right. That's absolutely right.
Was there a shift over time where the country went along and heeded the Congress more than the committee?
Good. So that's in the last 2 minutes that I have, I want to make that very point. You're 100% right. So what happened was in 1956, I believe, Ben-Gurion said to a World Zionist Congress, Jews living outside of Israel are violating the precepts of Judaism. And then free and prosperous lands, Judaism faces the kiss of death, a slow and imperceptible decline into the abyss of assimilation. So that's already, you know, the exact opposite of what the committee crowd wants to hear. This is Ben-Gurion saying the truth, what he really believes, that you guys are doomed to a death by assimilation unless you move to Israel. So the committee is angry at Ben-Gurion again. They're not happy about the law of return. They think the law of return creates dual loyalty issues. And so Blaustein and Ben-Gurion meet again in 1961 and issue a statement reiterating the validity of the 1950 exchange of views. But by this time, it wasn't as degrading to Israel, and it recognized a diversity of opinion about the meaning of Judaism, the meaning of Zionism. Levi Eshkol reaffirmed the Blaustein-Ben-Gurion agreement in 1963 when he became prime minister, and Golda Meir reaffirmed it in 1970 when she was prime minister. However, it was totally meaningless because it was a farce. The reality is that Israel called for mass aliyah after the Six-Day War. It didn't happen, but Israelis called for it. And the American Jewish community didn't do anything about it. Also in 1972, the Arabs protested in the UN about Israel claiming to speak in the name of world Jewry. And the American Jewish committee didn't protest the UN General Assembly's absence of a ruling. But then again, they weren't going to side with the Arabs. I mean, that would have been going too far. So the American Jewish committee, for all of its bluster about how Israel doesn't speak for world Jewry, the bottom line is it allowed Israel to speak for world Jewry time and time again as the decades went on. And the exchange between Blaustein and Ben-Gurion had no tochen, no substance in the long run. Why did this happen? Because the committee, as part of the general American Jewish community, is going along with pro-Israel sentiment. Right? Gone are the days when the economic and political elite of American Jewry really were hostile to Israel. Right? They fall in the same crowd as everybody else, which wants Israel to win its wars. They want it to be financially viable. They wanted to wean it off of charity. All this stuff is true in the 70s, 80s, even 90s. And so you don't have a legacy organization in America, one of the alphabet super organizations, being really hostile to the Jewish state or even lukewarm. Everybody's warm to Israel, warm to Israel. Now in the 21st century, it's Vanahapochu, unfortunately, in certain instances, and we don't have to get into that now because it's already 9:30 and we're time to shut it down for the night. Or I'll say something I'll get into trouble for. But that's my spiel on American Zionism after 48, which basically is pause in search of itself. It's looking, what do we do now? And how do we reconcile our ideological perspective with what the Israeli government and Israeli people are doing? Next week, we're going to discuss a very controversial topic, and that is the origins of the Israel lobby. So everybody heard the infamous Israel lobby. So among the anti-Semites and the anti-Zionists and the pro-Arab crowd, they'll always say, oh, the Israel lobby controls Congress. The Israel lobby controls this and that. Well, how did that actually come about? What are the origins of the Israel lobby? So we'll get that. That is slightly different from what we discussed tonight, which was more of an internal issue of, you know, Jewish sentiment. This is more klapei chutz, and to the government, what is the Israel lobby? Where does it come from? So see you all next week.